You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Yet again, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the last broadcast of 2020. Here at Radio Albion, we did a year in review, which aired. Today is Wednesday. It aired on Monday at 3. I think it's particularly good. I'm not sure why in particular, but I strongly recommend, if you haven't heard it yet, to go and listen to it. It's an hour long, first aired 2 days ago. I want to thank, more than anything else right now, that group of you who have assisted me, not just financially, but personally as well. You guys have made it possible for me to maintain my intellectual freedom at a time where intellectual freedom is extremely rare. It's extremely rare not just because of private sector censorship, which is everywhere, but simply because basic cognition, basic logic has collapsed everywhere. People aren't that bright under the best of circumstances. People are generally irrational and self-destructive. This is why things like the mythical market and liberal democracy, and I mean, these are all elements of liberalism, are failures. When you have a vacuum of power, you don't have anarchy. You have another power center, which very quickly comes and takes over. And when they do so, they usually try to cover it up. They try to claim that it's something that it isn't. Oligarchy is particularly good at this, because no oligarchy comes out and says that's what it is. It can't. It's aware of its illegitimacy. So it covers itself over with all sorts of slogans, universal claims, and the rest of it. And this goes back to at least the Renaissance, at least in our sense of the term. It is really based around the killing of the king on the one hand and alchemy on the other. I don't remember, I think it was 6 or 9 months ago, I did a broadcast on the counter-revolution in China after Mao Zedong's death in the late 70s. When Mao died in 1976, his supporters were rounded up by a more nationalist faction of the party, including his wife. And the very fact that they arrested and imprisoned Mao's wife suggests that this really is a serious counter-revolution, and that Mao had become unpopular, despite them using his image. Again, these sorts of movements don't initially announce what they are. I have an entire broadcast on the new constitution that they wrote, and the fact that they took a typical Marxist internationalist state, although with, you know, with Mao's version of things, Mao being the most prolific mass murderer of history. We have no idea. I mean, 60 million is kind of a high estimate. 40, 50 million is more the consensus. Unnatural deaths that he caused, directly or indirectly. But remember, even Solzhenitsyn, in the 80s, was saying that when the Soviet government falls, the new government should still use communist symbols. And his argument was that people can't handle a radical break like that. They need a certain level of continuity. So you have Lukashenko's government in Belarus, who uses all the old communist symbols, without, of course, having a communist economy or system. And it's the smart thing to do. And Solzhenitsyn said that in his Under the Rubble volume. Or from Under the Rubble, I should say. Now, part of what makes this show what it is the broad claim that everything that the average educated American, in other words, college-educated American, believes about the world is a myth. That's kind of the one of the underlying theses of this show, of this broadcast, is that when you have media elites in charge of not just news and entertainment, but reality itself, even if they wanted to speak the truth, they don't know what it is. Everything has to do with the agenda, whether it be building a viewership or promoting the agenda. Many of you have noticed recently that the agenda has taken over. The deliberate alienation of a huge portion of the American viewing public is perfectly okay. They're already billionaires to begin with, so they're deliberately driving away tens of millions of people for the sake of the agenda. Which goes to show that these, you know, market idea, the capitalist idea on paper is nonsensical. This is what you do with monopoly power. Facebook is deliberately sawing the branch that it sits on by driving away tens of millions of people. They're aware of what they're doing. So the agenda is just that powerful. It's overcome them to such a point that they're willing to go bankrupt, knowing full well, of course, that they're always going to be financially okay. Because it's an oligarchy, bankruptcy is really just a hypothetical idea. But at the very least, they're willing to lose tens of millions, or at least, by alienating us and not even trying to tap our giant market, which will remain untapped because the fear of retribution from the regime is far more powerful than the money that's available to them. So one of the things, I mentioned the China article. China, as of right now, is as close to a national socialist state as you're going to get in the world. Willis Carter was the first one to mention that to me. It was back in maybe 2001, and I never forgot it, and I think he's right. This has never been an apologia for the Chinese communists. That's never been what I'm doing. They're not communists. However, they still maintain the communist symbols. I've argued here, too, that the Communist Party of Russia is one of the most nationalist or national socialist parties in the world. I mean, they believe in an official Orthodox church. I mean, they're, you know, things that you would never expect of them. The fact that they use a bust of Lenin in their letterhead shouldn't be, that shouldn't provoke an emotional response. And it often does. And I understand it, but that's not what they are. Using the symbols is a matter of continuity. It's a psychological tactic. China is a national socialist state. Now, I remember starting in high school, I want to say 87, 88, it became very fashionable to believe that the Chinese government, now by that time firmly national socialist in its orientation, suddenly was an evil occupying power of Tibet. Now, Johnson's Law, such an obvious variable here, I don't even have to mention it. No one knows a damn thing about Tibet, and I'm not claiming to be an expert by any stretch of the imagination. I know more than 99% of Americans, but that doesn't say anything. I did a broadcast several years ago on the Russian relationship with the Dalai Lama, just prior to the revolution, the Russian Revolution, that is, and how the personality, the office of the Tsar, is actually mentioned in the ancient texts of the Tibetan lamas. And it took me a while to wrap my head around that, but it's true that the Tibetan system, Buddhist idea has the great leader of the White North as a central figure, as their system, sort of like in an apocalypse, begins to fall apart. So I have studied this region, and as far as the Chinese occupation of Tibet is concerned, and I hesitate to use the word occupation, because the Chinese, at least recently, have put far more into Tibet that is taken out of it. In fact, to a tremendous degree, China has built the economy from almost zero to an extremely prosperous state up until very recently. But I remember in high school it became very fashionable to talk about a part of the world that no one knew anything about, which is a phenomenon that made me laugh then, and it makes me laugh now. I remember Richard Gere becoming a Buddhist, or what he thought a Buddhist was. And from then on to maybe the early 90s, Buddhism became, I'm sorry, maybe early 2000s, Buddhism became the biggest Jewish fad since the hula hoop in American life. If you go to Amazon and read the books on Buddhism, you'll see Jewish names everywhere. I remember in grad school, I saw a cover of Time magazine that said, America's Obsession with Buddhism. That was the title. As if all of us are suddenly obsessed with this system. Now, I also did a broadcast on karma as a philosophical concept, with the conclusion that the way that the word is used today has no bearing whatsoever on its traditional usage, what it is. So I've dealt with some of these topics before. Whenever any traditional or ancient or medieval idea gets any kind of traction in modern bourgeois America, it is destroyed or at the very least distorted beyond recognition. It goes from an idea of some philosophical importance to a commodity in the capitalist system. And things like karma and Buddhism and everything else are victims of this. I've argued for several decades that Buddhism is not a religion. There is no God. There is no creation. Religion, by definition, has to do with the binding of man to God. That's what the word means. So without a God, or a God that's merely a symbol, it can't be a religion. It is primarily a poetic and philosophical system. And when you view it like that, you see that it's more or less profound. It's not a religion simply because they may use incense from time to time, or that there's a certain symbolism attached to it, or rituals attached to it. If Buddhism is a religion, then so is Platonism. So is Hegelianism. Now, the trendy Buddhist cause, which is still around, of course, and in fact, it's going to get greater and greater as war with China heats up. And I made this a guarded prediction, that the regime is going to attempt to goad China into a war. Now, actually, I've done whole shows on the clumsy attempts to have the Chinese fire on planes that are over its territory, and it is really blatantly provocative actions. But thanks to Putin, I think, both Russia and China have been more than restrained in their treatment of these blatant provocations. Now, you have the most advanced spy planes flying right over Chinese islands, taking pictures, and these are target mapping devices. So as this attempt to goad them into a war heats up, as the economy collapses, and this is what the regime is going to do, as the dollar collapses, the economy, production collapses, as people lose all faith in the system, including the dollar, the last line of defense for them is a war with a country that Americans don't know anything about. They'll go to the left and say this is an authoritarian, patriarchal state that oppresses peaceful Tibetan Buddhists. They'll go to the right and say this is a communist country that needs to be destroyed. So they'll be able to mobilize both sides in this massive war juggernaut, which the U.S. simply can't win. I've been through that at some length. But what's the truth of the matter? I've been a medievalist my entire life. I make no specific claims for expertise in medieval China, not by any stretch of the imagination. But there are certain things that are, at least from a historian's point of view, pretty much universally well known. And those things are that to one extent or another, Tibet has always been a part of China. From the Yuan Dynasty, which would correspond to our High Middle Ages, to today, Tibet's been a part of China. Again, to what extent or another, there was never any direct control. Now, in the High Middle Ages, the Yuan Dynasty established the Supreme Buddhist Committee, later renamed the Commission for Buddhist and Tibetan Affairs, and the Tibet Office, which controlled the military presence in and around the area. It set up courier stations, not to mention built its infrastructure, and consistently they engaged in a census of the area. They built many of the monasteries that the Tibetans have made central to their national identity. That was increased in the Ming Dynasty, which goes all the way to the early modern era for us, created a full administrative system. In fact, the Ming Dynasty conferred these aristocratic titles on both political and religious leaders in Tibet. It was never a perfect system. The control over Tibet was always more or less indirect, but it was in their interest to stay close to the capital. And the same thing for the Manchus, or the Qing Dynasty. They then created the Court of Tribal Affairs, the Ministry of Tribal Affairs. And they, in fact, conferred the Dalai Lama in his office. They actually created the reincarnated Dalai Lama system, or the living Buddha system, is from a drawing of lots, which was created, in fact, by the late Ming Dynasty and then became institutionalized in the Manchu system. And then starting roughly in the 1730s, the Manchus had full ministries actually in resident in Tibet itself. Emperor Qinlong established, or actually appointed, the seventh Dalai Lama, and he was an administrator for local government. So in this particular case, this was a direct rule. The 29 articles was the Manchu constitution for Tibet, and that continues. This never really changed. Now, the biggest problem was roughly around the turn of the century. I've spoken great length as to the battle over Tibet between Russia and Great Britain. The big difference between those two empires is that for Russia, the Russian Empire, as I said in my first book, The Third Rome, many years ago, and I say it now, it is not a commercial state. The Russian Empire usually lost money, Ukraine being one exception, in its empire, because the purpose of it was to create a set of buffer states to protect itself from the West. That was the point of the empire in the first place. But even in places like Poland and Finland, it's hard to even call it part of an empire. They had their own constitutions. They had their aristocratic system, especially Poland. It was 100% Polish. You had what amounts to a viceroy in the capital, but absolutely no more than that. It wasn't supposed to have independent foreign affairs, but it usually did. That's the loosest possible association you can have while still remaining a part of an empire. The British, on the other hand, were purely commercial. The British saw Tibet for many years, but certainly around 1900, as an untapped market. The British Foreign Office began to believe, the Foreign Office in this case in India, that the Russians were training and arming the very small Tibetan army. And the British were concerned that a pro-Russian Tibet would give Russia a direct route to British India. Which, of course, again, Russia had absolutely no intention of having any kind of military presence there. The concern was, however, that the British would not then be unable to exploit the area for its own purposes. The Dalai Lama, as I've mentioned before, became very pro-Russian. And because of this belief that they had Russian support, they refused the British commercial offices, the British commercial treaties. We all know what happened during the opium wars. Again, something else I've done a series of papers and one broadcast on. I think actually two. I did a two-parter of that. This was imperial capitalism at its absolute worst. Well, it's imperial capitalism. And as the British began to threaten the Dalai Lama in 1900, the Dalai Lama appealed directly for Russian protection. And now, this is something that very few people know anything about, and I'm embarrassed to say I didn't either. Maybe my Catholic listeners may know this. You had missionaries, especially French Catholics. Now, the French had no bearing on any of this. They were not an imperial power in Tibet whatsoever. And the Manchus had permitted French missionaries to operate in Tibet. The very fact they were able to permit them means that they had control over the place. And I suppose it was out of ignorance. Well, actually, it turns out that it's a bit more than that. Why these French missionaries, who also were doctors and scientists at the same time, were treated the way that they were. So in 1904, the British finally invaded Tibet to keep it out of Russian control. In 1905, you had a revolt, the so-called revolt of the Tibetan Lamas. And this revolt ultimately revolved around the torture and slaughter of the French missionaries and the converts in the area. The Lamas took Batang, burnt down the mission chapel, and murdered, and not just murdered them, but tortured Pierre Mousseau and Pierre Soule. The only thing that saved them was the Manchu invasion. Now, the aristocrats, and really the oligarchs at this point in Tibet, refused to permit the modernization of the army. We actually talked about this in oligarchic Poland, too. A strong army is a direct threat to any oligarchy. And we'll talk about the Buddhist connection to usury here in a minute. But they refused a modern army, which would be a threat to them. George Forrest was a British botanist, because no one had studied the flora and fauna of Tibet. It was really just this kind of this black hole in the mentality of the West. But George Forrest came under attack by the Tibetan Lama's military system. And he is one of the several witnesses to exactly what happened. The priests involved, Dumnard, these people were, they weren't just clergy, they were also scholars. Pierre Soule, was, again, obviously a Frenchman, who became popular because he also had medical expertise, and he was well-liked in the area. What the Tibetan medical system failed, he succeeded. That meant that he became a threat. Without modern weapons, remember this is 1905, the slaughter of the French missionaries, himself included, was pretty nasty. All except one of George Forrest's staff were murdered. And the Lamas finally caught Father Pierre Dumenard. They broke his arms, hung him by them. 3 days of torture, lashed to a post at the destroyed mission itself. Dumenard was tortured for days. He was secured on a stake, his eyes were gouged out, tongue, ears, and nose severed, and then his extremities also were severed, and they kept him awake throughout. Then, the body parts that they severed were sent by the Lamas to be displayed at their monasteries. And of course, all the scientific data, which was pretty substantial, in fact, he almost revolutionized the field here, were destroyed. Clearly, there was a threat there. So a group of very sympathetic villagers that were able to sneak Forrest out. They dressed him up in Tibetan costumes. Obviously he lost everything. Forrest was the sole survivor of this group and then became the, there were others. There were Chinese present who also were witness to this. Now, the sect that was responsible for this was a Gyulug sect, or the Yellow sect, going back to the 16th century. They came to prominence in Tibet by allying themselves with the Mongols, Altan Khan specifically. The Mongols created the, or I should say even popularized the Dalai Lama system. Dalai, in fact, is a Mongol term. And all these guys had the name Gyatso, which means, I think it means ocean. And the Mongols then posthumously recognized his predecessors as Dalai Lama. These are Mongol terms, not Tibetan or Chinese terms. And that tradition became Mongol tradition because they did very well. But that's exactly it. They came into existence solely because they were able to win over the Mongol overlords. So at least in that case, colonialism wasn't so bad. What happened then, after Altan Khan's death, and for the following century, the Yellow sect pretty much slaughtered their opposition, using the Mongols as help. So they came to power as a murderous group with Mongol support. Now, some of you know that the Mongols in Russia were not really Mongols in Tibet. It was two different groups of people. There is very little evidence that the Mongols in Russia were, in fact, Asiatic at all, but that would take me too far afield. I have much on that, if you're interested, especially on my my website. So Forrest eventually wrote, and he wrote it actually even before these events took place, that the Yellow sect ruled Tibet through force and fear. And one of the things that him and many others talked about was usury. The old government of Tibet had connected to it many money-lending agencies. In fact, collecting interest was among the big duty of bureaucrats. And the monasteries, and I use the term loosely because that's not monasteries in the sense that Orthodox have monasteries. It's more of a philosophical, think of it like Plato's Academy, more than, you know, like a monastery in the Christian sense. But of the three major monasteries, the Drepung, Sera, and Ganden, usury was almost 40% of their total revenue. It became a big part of the aristocratic and oligarchic rule in old Tibet. It was a monetized economy, or certainly more so than medieval Europe was. The claim was that about 90% of serf households were deeply in debt, and the way that they controlled people was through debt, which also, by the way, passed down through generations. In America, you die, your debt is canceled, but there it went from generation to generation. Now, I'm not about to defend Chinese collectivization, Mao's behavior, anywhere, Tibet or regardless. If you go to, and the only place really to get information like this is through journals, websites, books sponsored by the party. So when you read these, you have to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff here. And the very fact that Yushui was the main target of nationalist China's reforms there suggests that this is absolutely true. Because this was also something claimed, not just by the British scientific delegation, but also the Chinese themselves, both in the Manchu and the nationalist orientation. But later revolts, and this is prior to 1959 when the communists absorbed them, these revolts were based on, actually, 1959, this may have been 50s and 60s, this is the height of collectivization, were based on the mass killings of the Chinese Communist Party and the collectivization of farmland. And I should note, by the way, that the 1905 Tibetan Revolution, which slaughtered every Catholic they can get their hands on, and understand this, Catholics had nothing to do with the imperial design. France was simply not involved here. Overwhelmingly, you know, if this was a rebellion against the British invasion the year before, well, it's understandable. But why begin slaughtering Catholics, French Catholics? That was the issue. And therefore, there has to be more to the story than revolting against the British invasion. That's, you know, revolting against the British invasion, musically or otherwise, is probably never a terrible idea. But why the French? And again, my layman's opinion is that it has to do with the popularity of these men, pointing out the problems in the usurious system and the failures of their medicine. I'm a big fan of traditional medicine. It our forefathers were here because of it. You know, our life expectancy is going down under this present regime. But I have the feeling that by 1905, this had been perverted. It wasn't the traditional medieval idea anymore. More had to do with maintaining power. So there was nothing peaceful. There was nothing pleasant. There was nothing... I'm sorry. The point I was going to make was it was a Chinese Manchu invasion that restored order. The Chinese say what was left of French Catholicism in the area and stop that rebellion. That was my initial point. But there is nothing, this whole mythology that all of us grew up with, that Buddhism is this wonderfully peaceful thing that rejects violence. I mean, here, you know, that is the exact opposite is true. I don't know how you can have a Buddhist empire in, you know, it would be Thailand, or ancient Burma, or any place in Tibet. In Tibet's lamas were militarist and expansionist, although they did a very poor job of it. No different than any place else. You can't have a empire without violence. And the fact that no one bothers to ask that simple question, I don't know if it makes me laugh or makes me cry or both. Now, you notice there was an exception to this, and that was in Burma. What a shock that might be. Where you had, again, a cover of Time magazine of the Buddhist leader opposed to the illegal immigrant invasion in the Rakhine state in southern, southwestern Burma. All of a sudden, the facade was broken just for that guy being, you know, a Burmese nationalist. So you notice even their ideological mythology gets pushed to the side very briefly when it comes to someone who supports a nationalist system. So the regime's use of Buddhism is kind of like the regime's use of Islam. Generally speaking, it's in favor of it. It tells stories and myths about it. But once in a while, whether it be, you know, the Shiites or the Iranians or the nationalists in Burma, the facade will drop. They'll condemn that guy, and then they'll go back to worshiping them. So you see, this entire Tibetan regime came to power through extreme violence, maintained its power through usury and force, and in alliance initially with the Mongol occupiers. So for them to talk about how awful colonialism is, when in fact that's how they came to power in the first place, not to mention wiping out their opposition to make themselves a dominant sect in the country, you know, the words like irony don't exactly cover it. So, what's happened since Tibet was ruled by the National Socialist State? And remember, please go back to the broadcast on what's happened in China since Mao's death. The whole notion of socialism with Chinese characteristics, which is their official slogan, is their transition from Maoist Leninism to National Socialism. I'm going to describe exactly here the benefits that that state has granted to Tibet, that Tibet has been improved in almost every respect, including from the point of view of Buddhism, under the National Socialist government in Peking, or the Han racial system in Peking. So, very simply, from just over the last 20 years, the GDP of Tibet has gone from 327 million yuan, I'm sorry, 327 million yuan in 1965 to 92 billion in 2014. That's 281 times. The GDP of Tibet since 1994 has grown an average 13%. 20 consecutive years of double-digit growth, which I'm pretty sure is a record. Just, you know, the local tax collection has gone from 22 million yuan in 1965 to almost 20 billion in 2014, 14% average increase. So the massive investments in Tibetan infrastructure and education often derive from Chinese policies done locally. I mean, the value added in its industry has gone from 9 million yuan in 1965 to 7 billion in 2015. In other words, it's gone up 735 times, growing not quite 16% every year. This is, I mean, I don't think even South Korea can match this. Now, even if that's an exaggeration, if it was half that, it is still very, very impressive. Now, as I've said before, China, after Mao's death and the rounding up of his opponents, his supporters by his opponents, and the creation of the National Socialist State there, and the new constitution, several new constitutions, in fact, you know, you have people, including people on our side, the nationalist side, who think that China is this communist state. Well, communism is the same as Leninism and Stalinism. There is no private sector. There is no ethnic development. There is no ethnic nationalism whatsoever. It is officially an internationalist, regime where everything comes under the state. Without that, you don't have communism. I mean, that's being very simple. And the NEP in the Soviet Union being a exception done out of desperation, war communism was far more, you know, war communism became the standard. But even in retail sales, you don't have retail sales in Leninist systems. But, you know, roughly by the time of Mao's death, it was negligible. By 2015, you have now almost 40 billion yuan, an increase of 400 times. The Chinese currency has remained stable because it is a state-controlled currency. And even its foreign trade that is sourced in Tibet, has gone up from just 7 million American dollars in 1965 to well over 2 billion in 2014. Now, the claim has been that since 1959 and the Maoist takeover of the country, that the Buddhist system, for better or for worse, and Tibetan medicine, folk culture, was repressed. Under Mao, that was definitely the case. But like everything else in China, once his people were eliminated, very quickly after his death, after Mao's death, that all changed. Tibetan medicine, folk culture, Buddhism, and the language have not only been permitted, but subsidized. Mao's attempt at collectivization, as always, was an utter disaster that produced far more bodies than it did anything edible. Everything has changed since 1980, which is probably roughly the first year the post-Mao world began taking shape. And it's done largely at the private sector. Chinese government has established 18 pharmaceutical enterprises done according to traditional Tibetan medicinal methods. Even just basic drinking water, which was a struggle before, now has become the norm. In 2014, Tibet had almost 20 million tourists, which is something that no one mentions. The very fact that they have tourism throughout the country suggests that the place is doing well. I'm pretty sure the Chinese wouldn't want people wandering around there if it was this prison, as the system tells us every single day. Some of you may also remember my lengthy study on Western, the Xinjiang Uyghur alleged persecution, including the same concentration camps, killing little kids, all the propaganda nonsense. And of course, none of that is true. But the problem here is that you can't have a legitimate separatist movement when you have a country doing extremely well under the so-called occupying power. And it's hard to call it an occupying power when it's been more or less an autonomous part of China throughout, you know, since the Middle Ages. And there's no denying that at this point. Why would you have a separatist group when you have a massive economic explosion that you've had in Tibet? Were they going to do better? The road system, which never existed before, you have something like 50,000 miles a year that's been developed. 88% of the counties in Tibet has asphalt roads, which I know is not exactly the most exciting thing in the world, but it does tell you the infrastructure development, the railways, have exploded. None of these existed before. Tibet Airlines was established, which is odd because an airline usually is connected to independent countries. China created Tibet's own with a full airport network, which has something to do with the massive explosion of tourism. And the energy system, based almost entirely on different variations of hydropower and wind power, and they use geothermal and solar energy, has been a massive Chinese investment in the area. But by now, the economy has done so well that the investment is more or less local. And I could go on the boring statistics from telecommunications, the recreation of the urban areas, the building of hospitals that never existed before, basic electricity, where you have 100% of people in the capital that have access to electric lighting, which wouldn't have otherwise, 2,000 primary schools, and the institutions of higher learning that not only are Chinese established and subsidized, but are based entirely on traditional Tibetan theory. 193 medical schools have been established, three times that even just a few decades ago. So, you know, in 2014, per capita disposable income was about 22,000 yuan. Now that comes to roughly $3,300. But you can't really compare since the cost of living is so much less there than it is elsewhere. Regardless, that's an increase of 38 times. In 1978, you had 565 yuan as the per capita. Sorry, that's per capita disposable income of urban residents is what I'm talking about. And even farmers, herdsmen, have seen their incomes increase since 1978 by 11% a year. So again, what are the separatists claiming? Are they claiming they could do better? That they can increase the farmer's income by more than 11% a year? No, of course not. Everything is based around Chinese violence in the area, violent occupation, and all the rest of it, which simply isn't true. And they tend to not mention the massive number of tourists that are brought through the area. CCTV created something called the Happiness Index. The China Post Media Group and a few other places helped out with this. Now, you know, I'm going to make fun of this as if you can operationalize happiness. But they did a huge survey of Tibetans concerning their view for the future. Were you better off now than you were 10 years ago? And as far as the other areas of China are concerned, the city of Lhasa, the capital of the region, dominated this happiness index for at least the last 10 years. In other words, of all the areas of China that are polled, and these very large numbers that they polled here, those living in the major cities of Tibet are more happy about the future, more believe that they're much better off than they were before than anywhere else. You take that for what it's worth, but this is not an international matter. This is purely a Chinese matter. It's very difficult to see, and I said the same thing with the Xinjiang issue. Very difficult to see how any separatist movement would do better. Now, I've mentioned before that the Dalai Lama receives between $250,000 and $500,000 directly from the CIA. I assumed that was off budget. It is not. You go to the American budget, that huge telephone book document, you go to the foreign affairs section, you go to Tibet, and you'll see it's right in there how much money this man gets. He is now essentially the creation of Western Jewish media. That's what he is. What they did with Nelson Mandela in South Africa, they do with the Dalai Lama here. He has that look about him, that grandfather look, the grandfather everyone wants, this constant smile, every damn picture he's smiling. There's all these positive memes about him. And when you consider that Tibet has been the central focus, I mean, Xinjiang has changed that a little bit, of the CIA as far as China is concerned, you realize why this has happened. Which is why it was so important that I explained exactly how that system came into existence and how it ended up ruling. It wasn't that long ago I had never heard of the system of usury that was institutionalized in Old Tibet. But this is how these monasteries, again, these philosophical academies, the monasteries, maintained their position. But when you consider the massive investment in this country, and it makes a great degree of sense, China, more than anything else, wants to take over the number one spot in the economic figure it can. Chances are it is probably the first number one, economy, because so much of the American measurements are based on financial services, not on actual production. If you take just pure production, the U.S. is blown away. They have every incentive to make sure that its extremities, especially in the West, are well looked after. To have warfare over there, to have violent occupation over there, is about the last thing that Chinese capital wants. Certainly this that the state wants. You see how efficiently it dealt with this so-called virus? China is 100% back to normal. They have these huge soccer matches, there's not a mask anywhere, no one fears it. You don't have capitalists wanting to stretch this out for their own benefit. No one got massive subsidies. In fact, in the early years, the early months, those personnel that mishandled this over there have been arrested. I think at last count, about 105 have been arrested for either lying about it or manipulating the numbers, whatever it was, both positive and negative. Everything is 100% back to normal, which means the Chinese population is far freer than the American population. And that's not going to change anytime soon. Even something along the lines of low-income housing, something kind of, you know, boring like that. By the end of 2013, you had 27 billion yuan poured into new housing. 2.3 million farmers and their small holdings have been protected. Usually it would come under the domination of usurers, speculators, the big, agro-capitalists would have taken over by now. Their small plots are protected. That's the very opposite of what communists do. They collectivize. Their per capita living space has gone up to 30.4 square meters, which is a huge improvement over the decades. Massive heating project in Lhasa. The main gas pipe network. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But all of this says is that the Chinese government wants a nation economically unified for the sake of increasing economic dominance and general prosperity. No one can complain here. When I talked about General Chung Hee Park in South Korea, my favorite Asian leader, I think, of all time, there was simply no source for opposition. Why would you have an election if his performance in every area is stellar? Everything that South Korea has comes from his reign. How can you possibly fight him in an election? That doesn't even make sense. Opposition parties wouldn't make any sense. So they had to create, the CIA ultimately created, the democracy became an end in and of itself. Because there were no elections, we're going to riot. And therefore, their issues became how the police responded to the riot. That was their entire movement. Because there was no way they could talk about actual policy here. The exact same thing is happening in Xinjiang and is happening in Tibet. For the first time, you have clean drinking water everywhere. Telephone, radio communication, the use of clean biogas, which has been one of China's big areas of investment there. This massive, it's not just, when I say electrification, I'm talking about clean electric. Billions. The Chinese are in the process of wiping out Kashin-Beck disease, which used to affect something like 20 to 30%. Per capita living area, maybe, but especially in the poor, in the capital and elsewhere. Kashin-Beck disease is almost a form of arthritis that only affects East Asians, and really it's based only in Tibet, where you have this massive swelling in the joints coming from mold attached to grain. The Chinese National State has been the only one to finally begin to wipe this out. 2.6 million people have been brought out of poverty poverty by Chinese standards, just in the last decade. Massive improvements in irrigation system for small farmers, not the massive conglomerates that you have in the West. In fact, the only reason that you have small farming there is because the party has protected it as a major priority. Because as it turns out, small farmers are actually more efficient and better for the land than the massive agro capitalists that you have in the West that now need GMO to grow anything, because they've not only destroyed the soil, but they have sucked down the water, which, by the way, you've heard this here first, the desertification of the Midwestern part of America is going to be an issue soon. The water is disappearing. This is something that's been kept out of the press for a while. You have massive investments in traditional, legitimately medievalist medicine in the area. You know, in the Lhasa region, you've had 71 county hospitals, 678 township clinics in the rural areas for the basic free medical services, which, you know, in today from China is actually substantial. You know, if Mao would claim, you know, free medicine for all, well, medicine should be put in quotes. That's not the case anymore. Chinese have established 1,400 private sector medical organizations. And you have roughly today, well, as of a few years ago, about 4 hospital beds per 1,000 residents. Maximum payment for basic medical insurance now for urban employees is about 400,000 yuan. And for all other urban residents, about 200,000 or 300,000 yuan. And this is substantial. And because the state, rather than capitalists, are behind this, you don't have the insanity of dealing with insurance companies that you have there. Needless to say, the longevity of the average Tibetan has gone through the roof. Even as right now, I mean, just in terms of record keeping, 99% of the Lhasa region's people have medical records. Child mortality, infant mortality, one of the worst scourges of the pre-modern, legitimate scourge of the pre-modern era. I mean, I'm not idealizing it. That is a problem. Always has been a problem. But you now have a massive collapse in it. 1.5 per thousand. Average life expectancy has gone from, again, this would include, remember, you average in infant mortality, child mortality, and childbirth mortality. So it's not just longevity, but it was roughly 35 years in the 50s. That probably went down after Mao's invasion, but factoring in infant mortality, the life expectancy was about 35 years. Doesn't mean that they turned 35 and keeled over, but when you average zero into the mix, it's going to bring it down. Today, with that averaged in, it's 68.1. But claiming that somehow the Tibetan identity has come under attack is ridiculous. The Tibetan language not only is protected, but it's subsidized. The Constitution on regional ethnic autonomy says that every group has the freedom to develop its own language. Bilingual teaching in Tibetan and Chinese is carried out in every single school in Tibet. And it's bilingual pretty much everywhere. All major courses are taught usually in universities and high school level is in Tibetan. They're in Tibetan. And you have even Tibetan language courses taught in Chinese for those who don't speak it. It's an exam topic in college and secondary vocational schools. You have 30,000 bilingual teachers in kindergartens and the primary level. Tibetan is the primary educational language. And, you know, of course, learning Chinese is necessary for economic reasons. And English, of course. But if you go to court, government agency, Tibetan is the main language. You have to be able to speak it if you are in law enforcement. You have 14 Tibetan language periodicals, 11 Tibetan language newspapers, both at private and state level. All of this. You have the traditional Tibetan medical college established by the party. All of this is not supposed to be happening. And of course, the Buddhist tradition, for better or for worse, not only is tolerated, but it is subsidized. There's several Catholic churches there, believe it or not. That's been permitted and also encouraged by the state. The nonsense of China being opposed to religious expression is just that. It's nonsense. It isn't true. The only stipulation in the law says that the religious entity cannot be, foreign sponsored. Because they worry about what happened in Russia with these evangelicals, Mormons coming in as agents for the CIA, which is a very common phenomenon. As of a few years ago, you had one Catholic cathedral, you had four mosques, and of course the mosques most certainly are going to be watched closely because the mosque has been the CIA point of organization for the attacks on the Chinese state. So whatever the Chinese government does against religion certainly is, you know, at least equal to what you got to go through in America. I mean, they weren't banning religious services when COVID hit, that's for sure. But anything that might happen against them occurs because of how they've been used in the past. How these institutions have been used in the past to attempt to overthrow Chinese sovereignty. The idea that Tibetan Buddhism has been the method by which the CIA has attempted to split China off, Tibet off from China. And yet they still subsidize it from Peking. Shows you exactly what the policy is. And they have every incentive to make sure that there's a certain level of, contentment. You're not gonna wipe it out as Mao attempted to do. It's never gonna work. So rather than attempt to rule by force, it simply now accepted defeat, and of course the new government has a brand new policy over the last, since 1980. There is no way that you can have a legitimate separatist movement when you have this kind of a system there. When you have the massive economic growth, whether it be education, whether it be religion, whether it be medicine, whether it be industry, whether it be services, even retail, all of it subsidized by the state in Peking. And of course, it all has a massive private sector presence as well. But the private sector there has to follow certain state guidelines. You know, any foreign investment has to have a 50% local component, which of course is one of the reasons that, you know, foreign investment in that area is always, you know, they claim that this is oppressive somehow. But that's how it is. So when you have this kind of development, you can't have a legitimate separatist movement. They're not claiming they can do this better. They just don't talk about it at all. It's a foreign, manipulative, method to start a civil war in a very sensitive area. And whatever China does is done in this spirit. And yet they're taking a huge chance in subsidizing some of these, traditional Tibetan national ideas. But that's the nature of National Socialism. And yet again, what everyone thinks is true, you know, according to Johnson's Law, is completely false. That's what Buddhism is. That's what its history is, especially in Tibet. It is essentially today the creation of the CIA and your typical suburban female at yoga who thinks that going to Lululemon is going to support the Tibetan desire for freedom and independence. That's pretty much what you have. But as always, it has nothing to do with reality. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening and supporting me. And I wish you a very, very happy New Year.